And in order to stay on track, we're going to have our final speaker of the afternoon, or of this session anyway.
Just get this out of the way here. I'm using yours, I think. I didn't get copied over. So you're okay.
You're all right.
Okay. Thank you.
It's all working.
Presentation to you, or?
I don't care. I'm good.
Excellent. All right. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thanks for coming. It's been my favorite ASA conference yet. I think it's my fifth one. And each time I come, the hiati between them gets shorter. So I'm probably all in now. It's been a pleasure to meet many of you. I've had some fantastic conversations and developed some new friendships. So what a absolutely delightful time. So thanks for coming. My name is Mike Tennyson. I'm a biology professor at Evangel University in Springfield, Missouri. We are the National Liberal Arts University of the denomination, the Assemblies of God, a Pentecostal denomination. And what I would like to start off with is I had a group of students help me arm wrestle their colleagues into sitting down for some interviews. So these are students who I needed to make the other students care enough to participate. And then I have some faculty colleagues that help me with some terminology. Small grant from the university to help buy a $100 Amazon gift card for survey takers. Okay, so I'm a teacher at heart, and so I've been teaching for a long time. I'm in my 30th year at Evangel. And early on, I was trying to think of ways to help them think more critically. And I found that the origins discussion was a great foil to not just model, but to also examine weaknesses in thinking. And so I started using the evolution-creation debate, if you will, as a starting point for students to engage, ultimately not to help them land on a particular view of origins, but rather to certainly know why they chose a particular view. That led to the development of a survey of attitudes and beliefs about origins that a colleague and I developed. And because we're in the Pentecostal theological stream, we're publishing in this area more than anything. There seems to be increased interest in maybe Pentecostalism, as I think more Pentecostal theologians are coming into the mainstream, perhaps. I'm not sure why, but there's some interest. So, very interesting book to me, Science and the Spirit of Pentecostal Engagement with the Sciences. James Smith and Amos Young were the editors. We got the survey published as a chapter in this book in 2010. And one of our findings was that we've been collecting data now since 2004 on students at Assemblies of God universities and faculty at Assemblies of God universities. And I'm just going to show you some of the student data from these initial surveys. We're finding that old earth creation viewpoint is increasing from 04 through 15. That evolutionary creationism perspective is increasing, that young earth creationism is decreasing, and students are becoming less uncertain about their views, which is also interesting. We could talk a fair amount just about that chart maybe and have some fun. Some of these trends are statistically significantly different, others are muddy. Certainly the YEC drop and the OEC increase are statistically significant. We've got a diversity of viewpoints among Pentecostals on origins. How are they navigating the waters of integrating, or at least relating, faith and science? Because they've obviously arrived at some conclusion. How are they arriving at those conclusions? And so we started to we developed a survey on evaluating integrative paradigms, and so we were blessed to have an article published last fall, And it's a new survey instrument and its findings for relating science and theology. Myself and a retired theology faculty person and a neuroscientist at Baylor, we partnered together to write that paper. And what we did find from those data were that people do use different types of science and theology relational approaches to answer these questions. There's a lot of diversity out there. And so that's kind of what we documented here. And that has now led me to a new question is, well, how did they get there? This is, you know, that spiral that was so disappointing at the plenary talk. You know, I'm feeling like I'm spiraling, and I don't know where this is going to go, but I'm on the train right now. So to examine how do people arrive at integrative paradigms, and these integrative paradigms are non-overlapping magisteria, right? Complementarism, two views contribute to our total whole. Concordism, I don't use the standard definition of concordism in our research here, but I won't go into that. And then the two conflict modes, right? Conflict theology always wins, or conflict science always wins. So those are the kinds of models that we're studying, and we're evaluating what ways do people... And these data were more than just Pentecostals. We had a large sample of Baylor students. My colleague here, David Bundrick, had collected a lot of data from mainstream secular and religious scientists at Research One Institution. So we had a broader data set than just AG young people. But it's led me and others to think about, we need to kind of be trying to measure something that's really hard to measure, is epistemology. And we also need to try to measure hermeneutic approaches. Dennis talks a lot about that in his books. He does a great job. We don't have much empirical data other than it's kind of anecdotal. Well, you know, X number of your students report that they read the Bible this way, and I could say the same about mine. So we're in the process of developing some other survey tools, measuring epistemological approaches and hermeneutics approaches. And luckily, there's lots of instruments out there on measuring, do students use scientific methodology? So there's some tools out there already. We're working on the second and third bullets. And I want to talk about the first bullet today. So there's some context. Oh, some interesting findings, I thought, from the paradigm data. Most U.S. Research One Institution scientists and most Baylor students, those who do use integrative paradigms are complementarists. By and large, theology has something to say to reality. Science has something to say to reality. We should bring them together as part of a whole, but one doesn't necessarily inform the other too much. Among the data set that I've been collecting on Assemblies of God and other Protestant educators, pastors, and students, there's more concordism. Don't read this with the negativity that many of us have. This is not the defined alternative to accommodation. It's actually the idea that, is it Robert Russell's put this idea out, that science should inform theology and theology should inform science. So it's kind of an integrative complementarism idea here. And so there's a fair amount of that occurring. And then, however, of all the scientists measured, about half of them make no attempt to integrate theology and science. So all of the other data here are those people, of those who are attempting to integrate, these are how they're doing it, but half aren't. You know, so you know what I'm saying. Oh, and we looked at if a person identified themselves as a particular holder or adherent to a particular view, what kind of integrative approaches did they use? Young Earth creationists in our sample used both complementarism and then conflict theology over science. Probably no surprise, right? There, the theology wins over science if they appear to be in conflict. If they don't appear in conflict, then we'll go with complementarism. Old Earth creationists and evolutionary creationists favored complementarism, and then secondarily, they would go with concordism. Again, my unusual definition of concordism. So I'd like to report on some pilot study findings from the development of a instrument to measure epistemological viewpoints, and so we're calling it the Deciding Truth Scale. And the main idea here was to identify how do people evaluate truth claims And we're going to head particularly toward theology and science. So the domains narrow down to that. That meant we had to dig into theories of truth, and those of you that are philosophers will eat this stuff up, and the rest of us are going to say, I hope I can make it through the next few slides. I'm just going to make a statement about this slide and then kind of blow through some of the other stuff. But probably the two most common theories of truth that most people use most of the time are these two, correspondence theory and coherence theory. Correspondence theory, a proposition is true if and only if the real world is as the proposition says it is. And coherence, the veracity of a knowledge claim is affirmed when it fits other beliefs that I know are true. So most of us have heard those two truth tests. Kirkham in 92 wrote a seminal volume on this, and so I'm drawing my definitions from his work. There are other theories of truth, though. There's obviously utilitarianism, right? So there's a couple of different pragmatic approaches. One is, I'll go with the majority of you. Everybody that I like or trust, if they hold this view, that's my view, right? I'm on board that train. Instrumentalist, if it helps me be benefit, I'm going to call that truth. You guys with me on this? You guys heard these things before? Maybe a different nomenclature. These other ones are a little bit more esoteric to me, so I'm not even going to really talk about them. I'm just listing them as options that are out there that people seem to use, probably less and less commonly than these others. And then these last two are kind of important, I think, for people of faith, because so an appraisal theory of truth, a position is that truth is good, and good is truth. And then truth as justification theory of truth is that a belief should result when we remove all the doubts. And so rather than a positive case of evidence, we knock out all the other negatives, and then what remains is what we're going to believe to be true. William Perry, those of you that have had some training in educational psychology or pedagogy at secondary or college level, you've certainly heard of William Perry. And he developed, based on quite a large data set, and it's pretty standard nomenclature in the field these days, is the college students travel through four stages. They start out as dualists, right and wrong, black and white. They recognize uncertainty, so they become multiplicitous, and tending then to move pretty quickly because of this awareness into contextual relativism. The generation just before me, I'm okay, you're okay. I didn't actually read that book, but you've heard of it, and the idea that my truth is good for me and your truth is good for you. That would be contextual relativism. But then the most mature position is what Perry called commitment with relativism, which is combining personal experience with outside evidences and accepting some uncertainty. So number four is considered by educational psychologists a very mature way of thinking. Jean Piaget, a developmental psychologist, has contributed to the literature also, and you've heard, if you took psych anywhere in your whole life probably, lifespan development was a common course where this was covered. You had to learn these terms, and they may mean nothing to you now. I'd just like to point out that a vast body of evidence does suggest that people, as we grow and develop, we go through different stages of problem solving and thinking. But formal operational is the adolescent and adulthood name. So that's those of us that are teaching college students, these are the age group that we're working with, hopefully. And you're all thinking, yeah, I've got some of those other, yeah. Okay. And then there's egocentric thinking, which is the use of self-centered psychological criteria to determine what is true and false. And all the scientists in the room say, ugh, okay, right? Or no. This approach predominates in the pre-operational, it diminishes in the concrete operational stage, and then hallelujah, it shows a resurgence in young people as they move into formal operational. Adolescents and young adults go back to egocentric thinking. They abandon it in upper elementary school, apparently, on average, but they pick it back up just in time to come to our classes. So Richard and Elder have put together a real handy for, it seemed to be written for the biologist who's not the psychologist. I really liked it. A handy guide on the miniature. I saw the word miniature. I said, I think I can read that. To critical thinking concepts and tools. So this is from that resource. Egocentric truth tests. Egocentric thinking is truth is determined by how this proposition affects me. That's the basic idea, right? So what in innate egocentrism, what they believe is true, even though they may have never questioned the basis for the conclusion. In other words, if I believe it, it's true. I can hardly say it. If I believe it, it's true. It's not true because, I don't believe because it's true, but because, do you guys see what I'm saying here? I believe because I believe it, therefore it is true. That's innate egocentrism. And then there's innate sociocentrism. I'm hanging out with my BFFs, and that's my decision about truth. The dominant beliefs of the group that I belong with, that's why I'm going to decide if something's true. That's called innate sociocentrism. There's innate wish fulfillment, belief in elements that support other beliefs that do not require any significant change in thinking. I'm trying not to laugh. I'm trying to train myself not to laugh at the wrong times. Okay, so I'm going to believe in something that supports my belief that requires I don't have to change my mind, and I don't ever have to say I was wrong. Love is never having to say you're sorry. Okay, and then innate selfishness, beliefs that justify the acquisition of power, money, or other personal advantage, even when those beliefs are not grounded in logic or evidence, that's called innate selfishness, one of the egocentric truth tests. In opposition to egocentric thinking is what we would present as the monolith called critical thinking. And of course, we're not going to all agree on what critical thinking means. But the basic idea that most philosophers agree on are these, that we identify presuppositions, we evaluate truth claim validity and accuracy, we consider alternate hypotheses, and then we act accordingly. From Stephen Brookfield. So there's the literature background to studying how college students think. Are they egocentric? Are they critical thinkers? Are they trying to integrate? And so here's how we went about developing this survey instrument. We put together some open-ended prompts for a kind of a qualitative analysis of interviews. And we interviewed students based on what the literature told us, the ways that people decide what's true or not. And based on the interviews of these three students, then the responses to those prompts then formed the basis for the survey statements. The survey statements were then floated, if you will, by the content experts who affirmed that the statements did indeed address the point that we were trying to make. And then we also ran some statistical analyses, some exploratory factor analysis. I'll tell you a little bit about. So we had 313 students go after the $100 Amazon card. And I had of those, only 260 actually finished the survey. So I didn't tell them that in order to get the card, you had to finish the survey. I just said you have to take the survey. So I'll do that different next time. So we had these content validity experts look at the statements, and they affirmed that these ones were good and throw those ones out. And then we did this factor analysis, and it's a statistical procedure that basically gives evidence for what's called construct validity. And the word construct here means a way of thinking. And so the analyses did indicate that the instrument was had construct validity. And you've probably heard of reliability analysis, which is basically if a person of the same type of person took the survey again, would they answer the same way? And that's what reliability is. So based on the literature and our first look at the responses to our open-ended questions, we thought one of the what are called constructs or ways of deciding truth is that people might have some criteria for deciding what truth is. They actually know that there are some rules that this proposition should meet in order for me to consider it to be true. We're not saying what the rules were, but they had some rules. And so we expected to see that, and the highest loading factor from the analysis is one that we call critical thinking. And it basically supports the idea that those ideas that I gave you earlier of solid critical thinking approaches, there were students who were using those. So that was one way of thinking. A second expected way of thinking or mental construct was the presenter qualities that affect that the students were looking for presenter qualities that would affect the persuasiveness of their statements. Indeed, we found that we've named the factor something different to more tightly match the statement, important speaker characteristics. We found the third strongest factor that came from the analysis was this one that we were surprised by, actually. There's a way of thinking about decided truth among these Christian college students that says, truth must match my religious beliefs, be unwavering, in other words, not changing, and it must be accurate. It's a complex, those are three different words, but that seems to be the amalgam that was the third strongest way that students were thinking about truth, is what I'm trying to say. And we didn't expect that. We also didn't expect this one. You're saying you're at a Christian school, Mike, and you didn't think faith would be paramount, but I'm, yeah, okay. Another mental construct, which is just a way of thinking, think of it as a grid that you use to solve a problem, okay, is faith is paramount, but based on experience, we are Pentecostals. And, oh, by the way, we do happen to believe in the Bible, too, so biblically based. So on a posteriori reflection, yeah, okay, should have seen that one coming. Did I think that the millennials, who are so accused of being postmodernists, were going to be aware of this big thing, absolute truth, at all times, under all circumstances, versus relative? No significant factor of absolute versus relative truth came out in our analysis. So in our sample, there's no statistical evidence that any significant group of these students were wondering, is this an absolute or a relative truth? And we also thought that people would really resist new ideas, and that their basic stance was, I dare you to convince me I'm wrong, right? I just dare you. Lay it on. My faith is solid, or I believe this is totally true. We didn't find that one either. That was a surprise. And then finally, we thought that students would have come to college having thought ahead of time about, what am I going to do if I hear something that contradicts what I already think is true? Because my parents warned me, right? And we did not find any mental construct of that either. So these are some surprises. This is full disclosure, oops type things, okay? We also found that some demographic factors didn't affect their truth constructs. The level of religious commitment. We asked them, rank yourself on your level of religious commitment. I think it's 0 to 10 now. And we thought that the more religiously committed people would have different ways of addressing truth, and they don't. We were sure that the science majors would dominate on the critical thinking mental construct, and no, the art majors did just as well as the psych majors and the athletes. That's awesome. And then, could seniors possibly have a different way of... No, they've learned nothing about epistemology in the 4 years at Evangel University. So those are a little bit disappointing. taking the factor that the factor analysis statistical method gave us, number one, this is the heaviest loading factor called critical thinking, and going back into the data and saying, okay, what percentage of the survey respondents agreed that that is what they were doing? In other words, kind of like metacognition, I'm aware of what I'm doing. About 80% knew they were doing that. And a lower percent, near around 70%, were aware that they were evaluating speaker characteristics. A smaller percent were self-aware that they were doing this, and a smaller percent were self-aware that faith was paramount, and that they were using that as a filter, essentially, to decide what's true. Back to correspondence and coherence, I was happy that about 80% agreed with the statement that truth is something that's accurate. That would be the correspondence theory of truth, right? And a larger percent, about 90%, said that I do compare new information to what I know to be true. Those are pretty solid. Those are standard truth tests. They scored pretty well on that. B and A minus were okay. I think we're out of time, so I'll just end there and open up for questions.
Thank you.
Yeah, when it came to speaker characteristics, specifically, what were those? Because my way of thinking, there's a difference between a speaker who's clear, right, and whether that lends credibility to what they're saying versus a speaker who makes cool jokes.
Right.
And whether that lends credibility.
So I have those at slides at the end, and I go through all the items I want, but in general, they were characteristics that added credibility and winsome. I would use the word winsomeness. So if they were credible, if they had characteristics that made them credible, maybe what letters were behind their name, and then if they made the audience feel like they were liked by the speaker.
It's more pathos than logos.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Okay. Exactly. Yeah.
So continuing on sort of that same factor, did you pick up or did you test? My pastor as one of those characteristics versus, say, these faculty members I'm now hearing yammering at me at my college.
So I don't have data asking that particular comparison, but the features that made speakers trustworthy were what most pastors did, is that they... I mean, I trust my pastor that he studied the word a lot, and he tells us sometimes how much he prays and reads. I don't know what your pastors do, but mine does. So that's adding credibility, and then they make me feel loved. So that correlate, I could see a correlation with that, yeah.
Did you ever have the same students take both the science and faith paradigm instrument and the epistemology one and get to see whether there are correlations there?
No.
Can you please?
What are you thinking?
I would just be curious to see if there are patterns between students who have, higher ranking critical thinking skills are more likely to have a certain...
Maybe they're seeking more integration.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I can do that. Thank you. That's great suggestion. Yeah.
Would you classify this as a psychological analysis?
So sociological. Sociological. This is sociological research.
Okay.
What am I doing here?
You're in great need. We are in great need of you.
I felt in great need as a teacher to understand how to get my students to make them want to change, And so my dissertation was on this origin stuff, and I had the only person of faith was a Catholic person on my committee, and my dissertation defense, there was blood on the carpet when we were done, and this guy, who I thought was on my side, and partway through my defense, he pounded his fist on the table and said, "I am not a creationist," and it's like he hadn't read anything of it. Because he was conflating creationism with just the narrow, scientific creationism or young creationism. And here he's, he's Catholic, so he certainly is a creationist, but attitudes and beliefs, this drew me in. Attitudes and beliefs affect how we make decisions. That's kind of where I'm working from, whether we recognize or not. Yes, sir. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, so I also appreciated your research. One of my questions is around self-reported statistics, especially when it comes to something like this, about how I would make a decision.
Yeah.
I feel like pressure, it could be pressure from a lot of different sources, would suggest this is how I would make a decision, is not necessarily indicative of how someone in a real life situation does make this decision. So I'm wondering if this research speaks true, and if you made any changes, or are you planning to make any changes based on this?
Well, the purpose of doing content validity, construct validity, and reliability, these are empirical numerical approaches that are meant to compensate or identify the problems that you're talking about. And I haven't given you the data, but I'll just tell you the empirical evidence is that the content construct validity are high and the reliability is high. So in social science research, that's what we can do. I think playing it out in the real world and measuring how people respond is better.
So can I ask you the question then, from your experience of teaching these students, would you say that this is true about how they make decisions? Or how they make changes about information?
I don't know. I've been disappointed at the disconnect, the apparent disconnect between their theology and their practice. Enough. I've been here long enough to see that disconnect. This might be painting a little bit rosier of a picture on the emphasis on faith and belief related to action. I think you're hitting something rather important about living out our faith and our practice. It's kind of like your work on the biology text authors. If you ask them straight up, are you biased? Are you presenting? Are you teaching philosophy in this biology textbook? And you would say yes, and I would say yes, but they'd probably say no, right?
Yeah, I just wonder what the implications are if, you know, half of the scientists are not trying to integrate at all, and they are the educators in so many institutions, and yet if people are not able to fit a set of beliefs into or a set of truth claims into their religious framework, I mean, that would seem to indicate that you're sort of set up to fail in transmitting information, say, on something important.
There's a huge body of literature on how to teach evolution successfully.
Right.
Huge. There's lots of research on that. And what there's very little research on is how does the modeling and attitude of the teacher affect that process?
Yeah.
It's all methods of use this exercise, try this, here's the... And the problem is if you're not modeling critical thinking yourself and you're not modeling the scientific approach of, if there's new evidence, I'm going to change my view. And guess what? If we became, most of us, I think all of us didn't start out as Christians here. I don't know what your theologies are, all of that. But we underwent a major paradigm shift to move from atheism to theism, in my case, agnosticism to theism. We better be able to model our willingness to change our views if there's new data in science and in theology to our students. And I don't think it's being done. Why does a evolutionary biologist at Ohio State University, why can't they teach evolutionary theory in a way that isn't obviously offensive to a person of faith? It's like we're ignoring this whole point.
Absolutely.
Right? Why not just make it neutral? How about just value neutral? How about not mock the people of faith in your... So what if I don't care that you're a believer or not? What if I don't care? I would like you to learn what I'm trying to teach you, and if I keep poking you enough, you're going to stop listening. And we just, our secular people haven't caught up. I've got to hand back here.
Let me just interrupt very quickly. I'm sure our speakers would be willing to say and take questions individually, but right now we have a refreshment break and then another set of talks. So for those of you who need to slip out, this is the perfect time to do it. I just want to thank all our speakers this afternoon.
Thank you.